Even though you're baby boomers, you are having a less time in retirement and less income in retirement than your parents. Let's take a quick break and continue on that theme a little bit, and then veer off into some other stuff that's been going on. And you're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based. I'm sorry, Tufts Free, Freeform, commercial-free, community radio. And I often say Social Alternative is part of that community radio, okay? And you're also listening to 91.5 FM, WFMO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio, and Tufts Educational Radio, another way we describe ourselves. So we've covered all the bases, and thanks for tuning in, and stay tuned for the second half of Socialist Alternative Radio. But first, we're going to put on a couple songs here, one that kind of theme throughout the show, and then another one, well, you'll see, and we'll be right back.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, is all that makes the world go round, that clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. You happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ting-a-ling for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover, though you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14 karat yacht. Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, of that we can be sure. I'm being poor.
Money, 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 money.
See how love flies out the door. For money makes the world
go round,
the world
go round,
the world
go round.
Money makes the
go round,
that clinking, clanking sound of money, 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 money. Get it,
get it, money, 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 money.
Mark a yen, a buck or a pound, that clinking, clanking, clanking sound. So that makes the world go round. It makes the world go round.
Another 394,000 children were born into this world. They break like waves of hunger and desire upon these eroded shores.
carrying the curses of history. But a history it's unwritten. The oil burns in thick black columns. The buzzsaws echo to the forest floor. They shout, give us our fair share. South of here, two young men in makeshift uniforms peer into the misty light. And figures dart behind the trees as a snap of rifle rounds echoes out across the fields. Well, they hardly know their secret mother tongue. Yeah, but they recognize the duty to defend the flag hanging limp and bloody above the village church. Down by the river, your money men play paintball games. Here comes the war. Here comes the war. Put out the lights on the age of reason. Tell us some of those great stories, the ones about serial killers. Their dreams flow into savage toy. Cheer the siren screaming out across the city. We had three odd nights in succession. The riot season is here again. Dear Lord, lead us back to the valley of the shadow. Born in peaceful times. The world in dervish spinning around. Faster, faster, the center cannot hold. Like a world in dervish spinning, spinning faster. Ah, oh, the center cannot hold. Yeah, spinning around, spinning, spinning faster.
That was New Model Army with Here Comes the War. If you never have heard of New Model Army, they are one of these old punk bands that survived and continues to make music, or has continued until recently to make music. I saw them a couple times back in the day of TT and the Bears and places like that, 80s, 90s, Central Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, United States, blah, blah. Okay, so, and before that was, Alan Cumming. From that, is it Cummings or Cumming from the cabaret that came out in the, I think it was late 90s, that was a very successful run of cabaret, a sort of revival of it, and the song Money. And, you know, obviously put that on there because money, capital dominates the political system, which we were just talking about, and the tax thing and all that, the tax bill. And by the way, we do have international listeners. This show's heavily stuff happening in the U.S. And, you know, that matters, of course. If you're in another country, the power of the U.S. Reaches across the globe through imperialism, through a lot of corporate propaganda of all sorts, through culture even. And so anyway, maybe next show we'll get more into some international events. There's a lot going on internationally, of course, always, but things that also come back and affect the U.S. I know that in France, for example, you have a Trump type, a Thatcher type Macron in power now. You have the Trump getting elected, emboldening the far right in this country, making them feel more comfortable with spewing their race hatred and their nationalism and so on. That's a factor in many countries in Europe right now. And of course, you have the direct effects of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East and so on. In Africa, which we don't hear much about here, but it's there as well. In fact, if you find a, and I encourage you to look for this on the internet, I'll bring one in one of these days. I have done this before, just a map of current U.S. military bases, the ones that are known, the ones that are publicized. It's just phenomenal. It's like, I think there's 150 minimum. They're all over the place. Many of them circling the Middle East, but many in other countries. And it's just incredible. And so in this country, in the United States, for example, when there's a attack on social welfare benefits to the extent that they even exist here, through something like the tax, the unfair tax bill that's going to result in cuts in social benefits, bloody cuts in social benefits, and so on, but also direct cuts in social benefits happening at any time in the United States, and Democrats or Republicans in power in the city or state level. There's always this idea, there's never enough money, there's not enough money, you know. And this continues when there's a recession, when there isn't a recession, there's just never enough money. And what that translates into nowadays is basically there's never enough political will of the corporate political parties, of course, because it goes against their interest to tax the super rich, to tax the big corporations, meaning increase taxes on the super rich and the big corporations. So there's just no money around, you know. Now, here in Massachusetts, one state here in the United States, Massachusetts, where we're broadcasting from, there is a millionaire's tax that people, unions and community groups have gotten onto the ballot. I'm pretty sure it's going to be on the ballot unless the courts prevent it in 2018. And in many states, you'll see people trying to circumvent the conservative Republican and Democratic parties. And yes, both conservative, relatively speaking, and go into referendums. And then in certain cases, like we've reported on the show, there was a referendum for $15 minimum wage in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That Socialist Alternative led the fight for this. And we got it on the ballot for the last 2016 presidential election ballot, which a lot of people turned out to vote in the presidential elections, and it was polling at over 65%. Which is amazing. And Democrats got together with the Republicans. Democrats were against it, all but two in Minneapolis, and they dominate completely the city council. They were against the $15 minimum wage, and they got hooked up with some Republican judges and got it off the ballot. So it didn't happen until we just picked up where we left off. It was still polling very high, and within 6 months, a majority of the Democrats had changed their tune on that, realizing we were just going to keep fighting and bring it into the election that we recently ran a candidate, Ginger Jensen, for city council in Minneapolis, and got the majority of first preference votes and got 34% of the vote. Did not win ultimately because of the preference vote thing in Minneapolis, but mainly because the big PACs, the big corporate PACs, sent out 12 mailers to people's homes, and did a lot of other domination of the system like they usually do. But we came close and raised a lot of money to fight them. And we're going to make 15 a keystone or whatever, a key plank. What is the word I'm looking for? A main emphasis of the campaign. But they thought they would take that away from us. So just before the campaign, and because of the pressure of the movement that we helped start and helped lead, they caved, and we got 15. Now, unfortunately, Democrats, once they got a hold of it, they watered it down significantly, but there is a $15 minimum wage law now in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the first state in the Midwest, not one of the coastal states, as they're starting to say now, that passed such progressive legislation, and it will come in increments, but it is starting, and it's a brilliant victory. And So anyway, the where was I going with that? I can't even remember where I got into a digression, a good digression. But basically I don't remember the exact point I was going to make from that, but we'll go back. It's related to the tax thing and the Democrats. But right now I'm going to have to switch gears, and I had my eye on this, which might have thrown my thinking there, on a public service announcement or two that we need to do every show. And I used to be adept at finding good public service announcements in this notebook we have here. I like to go old school with the notebook. And I'm lately having, not finding the political ones. Ah, there we go. Oh, I got my touch back. Hold on. And so we'll go with these two numbers to think about. Public service announcement on U.S. healthcare. The concentration of healthcare spending among the U.S. population, and this goes back, this is a little outdated, but just back to 2009, talks about healthcare numbers. Think about 1% of the U.S. population accounts for 22% of total healthcare spending, and the top 5% accounts for 50%. Top 5% accounts for 50%. So in other words, the richy riches, the really super rich, are getting all these procedures done, and the rest of us, not so much. Because they can afford it, and think about that, what that means. It means basically that this society, the ruling class, is saying that the lives of the rich are worth more than the lives of the vast majority of working people that make up the population. By working people, I'm using that term in anyone that needs to work or tries to work or wants to work or comes from a family like that. So I'm using broad working class when I say that. They're basically saying that the ruling class, the capitalists, people like Trump, are saying, hey, it's okay that, and we're going to even make it more so, that only the top 5% can account for 50% or more of healthcare spending, because we deserve to live longer than the workers, the working people. Now, if Americans are divided into two groups, the healthier half uses just 3% of all medical care dollars, while the less healthy half accounts for 97% of all U.S. health care costs. Now, I understand that can skew across class lines, that last thing. And the whole thing here is a little ambiguous as to why they're talking about health care costs. I mean, you want to spend a lot on health care costs if you are doing the job of giving everyone health care and good health care. You know, what better resources for society, any human society, than the survival of humans? You know, I mean, like, you know, it doesn't make any sense to complain about costs the way they do when, number one, it's a capitalist system, so the costs are going to profits for the capitalists. And number two, if you're talking about cost in terms of like, well, somehow we shouldn't be spending that much, then you have to create a whole different type of lifestyle, not dominated by capitalism, to have very, very healthy people. And even then, you'd have a lot of the human productive productivity go into healthcare. Defined on a broad scale, that would be like something like eating properly, you know, growing good food and eating properly would be part of healthcare. I mean, really. So at getting enough time, leisure time to exercise, etc. So anyway, that's just a kind of a problematic PSA there, but I read it for you. Here's another public service announcement from WMFO. Numbers to think about: world wealth distribution. The world's 8 richest billionaires. Oh, this has been updated as well, but we'll go through this. The world's 8 richest billionaires control as much wealth as half the world's population combined. Oxfam International. I actually had that stat in mind the other day, or just earlier. I mean, I mentioned it, but I think this is an older one, but maybe it's the up-to-date one based here. It's, I think it says 2015. Yeah, share of global wealth 2010-2015. There you go. Okay, so according to an Oxfam International report presented at the 2017 World Economic Forum in Davos, these 8 men, they don't give their names, owned the same as the 3.6 billion people who make up the poorest half of humanity. This is from, they do give the names. Excellent. Okay, so first of all, this is from Oxfam. And the little footnote: world's wealthiest individuals are, number one, Bill Gates, in U.S. dollars, $75 billion, bones, dollars. Amancio Ortega, U.S. $67 billion. Warren Buffett, U.S. $60.8 billion. Carlos Slim Helu, U.S. $50 billion. Jeff Bezos, U.S. 45. Now, the U.S. is the in dollar amounts. I'll stop saying that. But basically, I'm giving U.S. dollar amounts. Not necessarily that they live in the U.S., but a lot of them do, of course. Jeff Bezos, 55.2 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, 44.6 billion. Larry Ellison, 43.6 billion. Michael Bloomberg, 40 billion. Now, am I saying this to demonize these individuals as people? Yes and no. It is evil to have this much, to have exploited people this much. But more to the point, you can be the nicest person in the world. But if you're going to be a capitalist, you're going to do the rottenest things in the world. And if you're going to amass this much capital and money, capital does not equal money per se, but they do use this money as capital, a lot of it, then you are exploiting the heck out of millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people. You are affecting policy. Like Gates, for example, is a big charter school proponent, you know. So he's using that money to privatize U.S. education, to weaken U.S. education, for example. And you could go on and on. Anyway, that is from some numbers to think about from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And I think I hit the PSA jackpot with that last one, given the nature of our show here. But getting back into the tax thing, we don't have that much time, but I'm going to rush through this. It wasn't just me. It wasn't just Social Software questioning the Democratic Party's lack of opposition, even though they voted against it, even though they, de Blasio got out and, did a symbolic rally yesterday in Washington and so on. Why certain people, and this is going to come from actually a very conservative source, why certain people are questioning, not very conservative, but a, relatively speaking, conservative source, why people are questioning the Democrats fighting this is that basically they have said in other forums and other recent utterances that they pretty much agree, some of the top Democrats pretty much agree with the cutting the corporate taxes or wanting to come up with some other figure on that, that they are open to tax reform, quote unquote, and they are open to bipartisan blah, 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 that kind of talk. It's not just rhetoric because there have been successive Democratic regimes, federal, state, local level, that have, of course, cut taxes and refused to raise taxes and so on. And the point of this article from Alternet, November 29th, Steve Rosenfeld, is that, okay, Democrats, what's going on here? You seem to be showing your, quote, fealty to corporate America. You're not putting forward any other, taxation, increases on big business, increases on the super rich. You are accommodating to the agenda set by the Trump administration. So just a quick quote. So why are the Democrats not making noise about a giant reverse Robin Hood scheme? They're making some, I would say, but not, it's symbolic. That at least on the Senate side also includes moves to gut Obamacare by ending the tax penalty for not carrying health insurance, etc. So he's describing what's going on a little bit at the time of the writing of the article. And he says, well, too many Democrats across Congress are still beholden to wealthier constituents, whether individuals who contribute to their campaigns, corporate employers who threaten to leave if they don't get more corporate welfare, or people in their social circles who get invitations to the Kennedy Center galas. Okay, so that's pretty clear. Now, one thing I find interesting about this is the author, Rosenfeld, wrote a book about, quote, he writes for Alternet, but he wrote a book called Who Controls Our Schools? How Billionaire-Sponsored Privatization is Destroying Democracy and the Charter School Industry. Now, that 2016 Alternet ebook. Now, that's interesting because what you find the minute you get into the issue of charter schools is the Democrats are in it up to their necks. They like it. A lot of the leading Democrats like it. Obama liked it. There's a whole push among wealthy Democrats, Democratic Party officials, and their wealthy backers to privatize through charter schools, to go to increase charter schools in the United States. Now, what I mentioned earlier about this article quotes Paul Krugman, who is a New York Times op-ed columnist, who I consider quite conservative. I think would be conservative by any normal standards around the world. Of course, in the United States, I guess he's called something else. But he goes on about what, you know, why the Democrats aren't doing that much. He goes, quote, top-down class welfare coupled with false claims to be cutting taxes to the middle class has been standard GOP operating procedure for a time. Perhaps the Democrats are becoming numbed to that that constant thing. Now, I would say they participated in it quite a bit, and that's provable, very provable. He says that, the other thing he says, like, look, he doesn't say this actually, but something I just glanced at reminded me of it, but I'll give you one more quote from this article. You can read it yourself, but just quickly. Basically he's going on, he's pointing out some of the flaws in it, which is good. Suppose the tax bill. Suppose that a child from a working-class family decides, despite limited financial resources, to attend college, probably taking out a loan to help pay tuition. Well, guess what? Under the House bill, that interest would no longer be deductible, substantially raising the cost of college. What if you're working your way through school and your employer contributes toward your education expense? The House bill would make that contribution taxable income. The list doesn't stop there. You get the point, but we're not hearing many Democrats demand any reform be progressive. To drive the point home, the progressive tax policy could fairly support many needed policies and programs. If that's too abstract, then maybe Democrats should be shouting in the name of not burdening and hampering the next generation to pay for today's excess. But whatever the reasons, a larger point appears, the quandary that has been noted on off-the-record listservs where insiders talk freely about politics policy. Why aren't the Democrat leaders raising more hell about the worst GOP tax plan ever? Why aren't they doing more to stop a juggernaut from getting close to passing? One that panders to those who don't need more money at the expense of future generations. Why are so many Democrats acting like the majority of Republicans? So he's, you know, coming at it from a liberal standpoint. There's well-worn answers to all those questions because Democrats have a lot of common interest as capitalists or representatives of the capitalist class, etc. But the point is that that this is a time where it's easy for the Democrats to posture and promise the world to everyone because Trump is so horrible. And set in motion the paradigm that's just a fixture of American politics since the beginning of the 20th century, really, or into there, and even before that to a certain extent, that there's no other choice beyond the duopoly, beyond the two corporate parties, and they're going to get in, and they're not going to undo if history shows any pattern, they're not going to really undo what the agenda set by the Trump administration. They're going to build on it. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan, for example, who's often blamed, and I don't care about the blame part, but I mean, it's just inaccurate, often blamed for the start of neoliberalism in the United States. If you look back, it was early under the Carter administration that accelerated deregulation, cuts in corporate taxes, cuts in individual taxes, and so on, that the Reagan administration then built upon. And this is despite the Democrats being, I think they were in control in the beginning of the Carter administration. I know they were in control at the beginning of the first 2 years of Clinton, first 2 years of Obama. I have to double check the Carter thing and where Congress was at. I'm pretty sure the Democrats were in control. The other thing that I'm hearing in this tax thing that we've been talking about is that the tax bill is that, this will last for X number of years and then it will be whatever, you know, and then it will go away or this other part will last X number of years. I'm like, wait a minute, you know, if you elect a new government, they can pass laws to get rid of the previous laws, you know, they can pass laws that are new. And so this whole thing about this is stuck for the future, it's just not true. I'll give you an example. In Massachusetts, they passed a law that was a progressive law, barely, but a slight increase in the minimum wage. But a lot of the liberals thought they were doing us a big favor. You know, we're going to increase the minimum wage from, I think it was $8.75 or $9.25 up to $10 and eventually $11, this incremental increase. And it's working its way up now. I think it hit $10. And but if you live in Massachusetts, especially Eastern Massachusetts, you know that's nothing. That's because the federal minimum wage and the state minimum wages haven't kept up with inflation at all, and because they've stayed very, very low, that that this is not a big thing. And you know, the liberals were expecting a lot of cheering and thrills and, you know, accolades and so on from this bill that didn't begin to address the need for a living wage, even though it was a slight improvement. So this year, there's going to be, unless the courts get rid of it, there's going to be another minimum wage law, this time pushing up to 15, which is good, a good step. Still not living wage, but a good step. And there's some exemptions and things. There's problems with it. Unfortunately, it's got the thumbprint of the Democrats on it. Never really go for anything. Just, you know, go for the minimum. And now 15 is so popular now around the country that, they've managed to come out with a 15 bill that still is messed up, which is like, wow, what a talent you have for concessions before anyone asks for concessions. You know what I mean? Concessions before the battle. It's like going into battle and then saying, okay, right flank, go home. We're just going to attack, with what's left, because that makes us look weaker. And, you know, but of course it's more complicated than that. It's really that they don't like it, you know, the Democratic Party being forced to, actually it's not the Democratic Party. It's unions and progressive and left groups and community groups pushing this, but to allow it to go through, is something that, you know, not opposing it, is because the Democratic Party doesn't really want it, but to oppose it would cost them a lot of votes, because it's polling very high, it's very popular. And if it goes through, if it doesn't get torpedoed, like, for example, you think I'm, you know, if you want examples of what I'm talking about, there's just so many, but like, for example, recently in California, there was a big push by, I'd say, the people, you know, like lots of progressive groups and unions and so on, for single-payer health care. And what happened was that there were a certain number of Democrats that supported it, but there were some that didn't. That didn't get much press, right? That didn't get much corporate media, and a lot of the liberals ignored that. But what happened was Jerry Brown, the governor, big Democrat, was not for it, not for single payer for California, no. And some others weren't. So when it got time to, and the California Nurse Association, which is a powerful union, a good union, was pushing for this, it got to the point of going on the referendum. Sound familiar to the story in Minneapolis? Just give a listen. A Democrat politician using some law basically got it tossed off the ballot. And right away, Brown said, yeah, it wasn't time yet. And other people chimed in. And boom, the movement is left with egg on its face, like, because a lot of them supported the Democrats. Like, this was going to go through the Democratic legislature. They gave up on that. Then it was going to go through this referendum. Can't even do that, you know? And doesn't mean they're all going to jump ship from the Democrats. Although National Nurses Union, which the CNA in California is a part of, has been supportive of independent politics. They endorsed the Ginger Jensen Social Alternative Campaign. The Minneapolis Nurses Association endorsed that most recently in Minneapolis. So it's it's a situation where if you put the idea of making improvements in social welfare, if you put the idea that all these bad rules and laws are going to be reversed when the Democrats get in power, or more importantly, if you are trying to organize for fundamental change to democratic socialism and you still support the Democratic Party, you're setting yourself up for a well-worn path of disaster that has happened consistently in U.S. history, and also equivalent ways in other countries, and at least in those countries, more along the social democratic line. By the way, I saw this article. This is going to be a bit of a jump, but most wealth isn't. It's capitalism. Where did this come from? It's like, you know, you print these things out, and the citations just disappear. Like, I don't know if that's deliberate or something. Let's see. The Open Democracy. Okay. Under capitalism, on a website, Open Democracy. Most, quote-unquote, wealth isn't the result of hard work. It's been accumulated by being idle and unproductive. And I'm going to repeat that title just for your casual listener that tuned in to Socialist Alternative Radio, by the way, because this is so, it goes so against the propaganda that we're fed by everyone, even our parents. You know, our parents are like, work hard and you'll get ahead and all that. And I'm a parent, and I have to talk about working hard. But I try really, really hard to distinguish between who you're working hard for and why. and I really try to make that clear. I don't always have the time to explain everything, but, you know, I really try. Because hard work is a good thing for humanity, for people, for an individual. If you're working at something that's good, that will help you and the community and the planet and so on. But most work under capitalism, I won't say all work under capitalism, because as long as it strengthens the system, is not good work. Because for every good step forward you might think you're making, say you're a healthcare worker, I help save that person's life. That's definitely great. That's brilliant work, right? But you're doing it within a system that's killing people, a healthcare system that's not providing healthcare for as many people as it could, or providing quality healthcare for as many people as it could. And people are actually dying. So I'm not saying you're complicit in that. You're not. I'm not one of these, like, part of identity politics, I would say, but a lot of other strains of postmodernism and other things that, since there's no, since institutions are not given their full weights and systems are not given their full due as to how they operate and what they coerce people into doing, then it all comes down to the individual. And everybody's complicit in every bad thing. And that's just not true, really. And it's not true under capitalism. You know, you see these things on Facebook where people say, hey, you don't like capitalism? Live off the grid like I do, and it's really cool out here. And, you know, no, you're not living off the grid. You just think you are, you know? The reality is that an economic system pervades all aspects of society. Question is, who are the exploited and who are the exploiters? Who are the entrepreneurs, exploiters, and who are those that have to work for a living, right? That's the question. So I hope this article gets into this. I actually didn't review it carefully for the show. I only glanced at it and read it a while ago. Most wealth, I don't even have a date on this thing. Oh, man. Okay, Open Democracy, Lori McFarlane, sometime within the last millennium. No, I'm definitely recent article. I only talk usually November 13th. There you go, Open Democracy. Most wealth isn't the result of hard work. Listen up, people. It has been accumulated by being idle. That's wealth has been accumulated by being idle and unproductive. One of the basic claims of capitalism is that people are rewarded in line with their effort and productivity. Another is that the economy is not a zero-sum game. The beauty of a capitalist economy, we are told, is that people who work hard can get rich without making others poorer. But, and then this is actually an article about Britain, so don't turn off. I know people like, oh, Britain, it's not here. Same economic system. Sorry, although they have national health care, so if you live in Britain, at least you have that. How does this stack up in modern Britain, the birthplace of capitalism and many of its early theorists? Last week, the Office of National Statistics, they have an Office of National Statistics, released new data tracking how wealth has evolved over time. On paper, the UK has indeed become much wealthier in recent decades. Net wealth has more than tripled since 1995, increasing by over £7 trillion. This is equivalent to an average increase of nearly £100,000 per person. Average being the key word there, by the way. Impressive stuff. But where has all this wealth come from and who has benefited? Just over £5 trillion, or 3/4 of the total increase, is accounted for by increase in the value of dwellings, another name for the UK housing stock. So the article basically goes into how this bubble in property values, and this has happened in other countries like Japan and so on, is just enormous now. Like, no one can afford to buy a house now, and it's largely the case here, but I think it's a little worse in Britain. Almost no one can afford to buy a house. And there's just bubble happening in the real estate, values, let's say, real estate prices. And of course, this bubble is really skewed towards, like, remember this fire happened in Glenville, this horrible fire happened in a public housing apartment building in London. What they found was that there's an attempt, and this happens in other places too, Cambridge, Mass. As an example, attempt to have some public housing at least integrated in with other housing, or public housing starts off in a neighborhood that's sort of working class or whatever, and then it starts to get gentrified. And that's the case in this case of this tower of public housing existing under all these, among a very rich neighborhood, parts of it. And they found out after the fire that a lot of the dwellings, the rich people's dwellings, were vacant. They weren't lived in, or they were lived in only a very short part of time during the year, and they were basically investments. So this bubble in housing prices affects, of course, people that maybe hung on to a house from older times, when there was less of a inflation in the housing prices. But what it's getting at also is that all these people using, and companies using, housing for investment schemes and doing nothing, basically. I mean, it's just sitting there for the most part, you know. I mean, they might renovate it a little bit at one point, but I mean, basically it's just sitting there and being hardly used at all. And that's becoming now this huge source of bubbleized, if you want to call it that, wealth in Britain. Another article that goes against the grain, and I like it that for that reason. It's one reason I'm talking about it briefly. Is and I'm gonna have to really point you to the article rather than get into it. But neoliberalism has conned us into fighting climate change as individuals. In other words, neoliberalism has in terms of the control of the corporate media and so on, has basically convinced a lot of people that you can fight climate change based on your individual consumption. And the byline here, or the subheading, is stop obsessing how personally green you live and start collectively taking on corporate power. This is a great article, and it's from True North, Martin Lukacs. It's earlier in the year, July 2017. I've often focused on an article that that got a lot of play on the internet by Derek Jensen called Why Shorter Showers Aren't the Answer, or something like that. It came from Orion Magazine originally and has done the rounds now. Derek Jensen. And it's all about that, too. Very colorfully explains how minuscule individual consumption is compared to corporate consumption, and on a lesser scale, but still very huge, compared to military consumption. And the corporate consumption and the corporate rules and values reign politically through money and influence, and convince people then about their little green lifestyles and recycling and so on, and it does nothing to really get at the heart of the problem. Whether it's fossil fuels or just plain litter or something, and, you know, that kind of thing. Now, last but not least, till the end of the show, we're going to point out a few things in the latest issue of Socialist Alternatives, new newspaper. It's November issue, and we're into December now, but there'll be a December issue out as well, but I didn't get a chance to talk about the November issue, so I thought I'd bring it up. You can still get a copy, obviously. Go to socialistalternative.org. Get in touch with us, whatever, and a lot of it's online. This issue came out when we were working hard nationally on the Ginger Jensen campaign, but there was still a lot of other stuff going on. So, for example, members of Socialist Alternative in Boston started a Pat's Fans Against Racism as part of the whole Colin Kaepernick, I'm just using that for shorthand, the movement against racial injustice and other forms of injustice, as well as there's socialists, including Social Alternative, finding ways to take the Me Too message of the fight against sexual harassment and exploitation of women and increasing, amplifying that. We don't trust the corporations to solve those problems. There's a good article on DACA. And that part, despite a lot of the anti-Trump protests and so on slowing down and disappearing, which was predictable, unfortunately, because, again, Democratic Party doesn't want to lead them. AFL-CIO leadership doesn't want to lead a mass movement. They're too tied to the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, too tied to the Democratic Party, doesn't want to lead a mass movement, starting with his periphery and so on. So some of the people that have built up some Democratic Party through its money and so on, but other organizations that have the capacity to lead a movement against Trump are retreating from the field in that sense. That could change. But good article about the DACA being one movement sort of below the radar among immigrants that does continue to grow in some areas and has fought well. There is a article about impeaching Trump, and this becomes a big discussion among liberals and progressives and also the left. Why would you want to impeach Trump? Here's the shorthand of the argument, because we're running out of time. Why would you want to impeach Trump when you have Pence waiting in the wings, the Republican Party administration there, and all that kind of stuff? And that's a good question. The reason is that there's two main reasons. One is that an impeachment of Trump would really destabilize the situation. It wouldn't be just like Pence would take power in a strengthened position at all, and they would. I mean, the corporate media and so on would try to prop him up, but it wouldn't be this position of a seamless, transition to another despot. It would actually be technologically, just check something out. Yes, okay, thank you very much. Okay, so anyway, you would have a destabilized, weak administration after an impeachment, And who knows, you know, I mean, building movement to impeach Pence as well. I mean, the ruling class would still be in power, but it'd be a ruling class under attack on the defensive. Okay. Much different than Trump crowing about starting to get a tax bill passed. And it could give power and embolden other movements that are already incipiently out there, like the DACA movement, like the periphery around Sanders and so on, like people fighting for LGBTQ rights and environmental rights and women's rights and so on. With a weakened Trump administration or an obliterated one through impeachment, and then you have the Pence administration, whatever, this would really add. And you can look at what has happened historically. Like when the Nixon administration was weakened, a lot of progressive things were passed, despite Nixon being an arch right winger. You know, not this is not at all saying anything good about Nixon. It's just saying, look, if you have a weakened, regime in power, Republican or Democrat, I would add, then you have openings, right? You have things that you can take advantage of. Rather than one that's ascendant and that people are rallying around. Like, I can't tell you how many liberals I've heard say things like, well, he is president about Trump, and well, he is. And this was back when the Trump, the massive women's rally, which was really excellent, and the rallies after Trump got elected, this almost spontaneous. They weren't spontaneous. Actually, a lot of them were organized by Social Alternative in many cities, or triggered by Social Alternative. But there were a lot of rallies after Trump got elected. And again, this discussion, immediately we were having a discussion within Social Alternative, how long is this going to last? Democrats aren't going to be interested, obviously. And sure enough, you had liberal talk show radio hosts and so on saying, well, you know, he is president and blah, blah. And making Trump the new normal, basically, you know. And then there's been a guerrilla war on the Russian stuff. You know, they would like a surgical little, you know, removal of Trump based on some legalism or something. But other parts of the ruling class are like, no, you can't have that. Oh, you can't open up the office and so on. And look, he's cutting taxes. You know, so basically you have a significant section of the ruling class, you know, yeah, normalizing Trump, basically. Normalizing Trump, including a lot of Democrats. And we don't want to normalize Trump, by the way, here at Socialist Alternative. And we are saying, yes, impeach Trump. There's a good article here about the tax reform. This is in the new issue of Socialist Alternative. Go to socialistalternative.org, November 2017. I know we're in December. I know. But, shows every other week, so whatever. We got the paper out late because of other pressures. But this article by Teddy Shibabwa, yeah, sorry about the pronunciation, Teddy. Gets into the Paradise Papers thing, the Panama Papers. A really good article connecting the dots, and then it ends on what I was just talking about earlier. What also that other article I was quoting was talking about. How about taxing the rich instead of Trump's tax plan? There should be massive increases in taxes on the super rich, the banks, and the Fortune 500 companies. We've spent years bailing them out for no real return on investment for the vast majority of working people. We can use the increased revenue for a massive new green jobs program and to pay for high quality public higher education and child care services. Any party worth its salt as defender of the 99% would be fighting loud and clear for those demands. Yet all the corporate-controlled Democratic Party leadership can manage to do is say how bad the GOP tax plan is and commit to voting against it. That's not enough. They could mobilize mass public opinion against it, but they refuse to do that because those mobilized will likely go beyond the program the Democratic leadership will accept, and it would also bite the hand of the donor class, the capitalist class, that feeds the Democratic Party establishment as well. While taxing the rich is a first step, it is not enough. As long as the wealth is controlled by the top 1%, they will find ways to hoard as much as possible. We need to fight for a socialist society in which the top banks and corporations are taken under public ownership, under direct democratic control of workers, consumers, and the broader public. Only then can we guarantee that the world's wealth is used for full public investment in jobs and social services. So I thought that was a great short article. Teddy got a lot in there without much word count. I've got an article in this latest issue. I got a nice word count on this. This is Supreme Court considers Janus, JANUS. You probably haven't heard about this. The corporate media could care. Unions need to fight back. And this is basically about an extension of right-to-work legislation of all sorts of things, weakening unions, laws to weaken unions that have happened in many states. And this one is going to be an attempt to go national. To go before the Supreme Court in in the early spring, most likely into June, maybe. And with the Supreme Court, with labor laws and the Supreme Court, you can bet they're going to probably rule in favor of the plaintiff, this Janice who doesn't want to pay union dues or be represented by the union and still not pay union dues, et cetera, et cetera. Despite writing this article, I think it's worth reading. It's pretty comprehensive, if I don't say so myself. And it talks about how, like with Trump, the labor leadership is not organizing a mass movement against this. What they've decided, it seems, at least so far, is including public sector unions, that is the target of this. This is a law, basically, if passed, or a decision that, if passed, would enable nationwide the attack on unions, that unions, even though they are forced by law to represent everybody that's in the bargaining unit or the place they work that they represent as the union, even if they're forced to represent everybody, including non-union members, including current fee payers in those areas, this would result in nobody, union members, fee payers, mostly union dues payers and fee payers, would not have their money deducted out of the check, would not have to pay. So the unions would have to go around and convince everyone every month to pay union dues, which isn't on paper a bad thing, except that they still have to represent these people that paying fair share, and they would just opt out. Also, the right-wingers, whenever this happens in right-to-work laws, they come in and they chip away as much as they can, or obliterate, if they can, the union structure, because they know the union has less money to defend itself with. So they'll come in and say, hey, you don't have to pay dues at all. And some workers will go along with it, not realizing this will undermine the union. And pretty soon the union, in many states, the unions have disappeared because they can't financially survive the law, the edict that says they must represent everybody on no money coming in, basically, or very little coming in once the attacks start. And on top of that, once something like this opens up, where unions are not allowed to collect dues and fees automatically from workers, then basically what happens is that other laws are tacked on. Or, for example, in Wisconsin recently, other laws were put in there about unions have to recertify themselves every year and all these other things that, piggybacked upon the attack on the basic revenue of unions. So this is a really horrible thing, but instead of organizing a mass movement against it and making the case for, people, a fair situation where if unions are forced to represent everyone and you can only have one union per workplace and all these other things that the NLRB put into National Labor Relations Board put into practice with the Taft-Hartley Act, which, by the way, the Democratic Congress passed, it's just sets the unions up to a very unfair situation. And instead of like explaining that to people and going on a offensive about it, the union leadership seem to have said, basically, okay, we can't really fight this nationally. We can't organize non-union people to support us. So what we're going to do is just within our existing unions, we're going to strengthen our networks and shop steward structures and union representative structures and so on, and be able to weather the storm, be able to still collect dues from those we can and so on, and hunker down until maybe get some Democrats reelected. Well, there's no guarantee. I don't know if Democrats that go in and reverse labor law that's bad against against the labor movement. For example, Obama got a lot of union support of the official labor movement leadership based on a promise to push through a thing called EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, which would have taken away some of the most onerous laws and practices that are illegal but aren't enforced, aren't attacked against union organizing, and make it easier to organize unions and rebuild the base of unions in the U.S., increase the base of unions in the United States, union density and so on. And no, Obama not only never put it forward as a bill, just didn't act on it. And the Democrats, there was no pressure from other Democrats to do that, any real pressure, and it just disappeared. And that's one of many, many promises from the Democratic Party to the labor movement. And so here we have a situation where instead of hunkering down and waiting till 2018 or 2020, actually this would, if it more like be waiting till 2020, and then trying to get like internal networks, which is fine as far as it goes, but that should be happening anyway, of dues collection going, that's not enough. That's not enough. There has to be a national fight organized for union rights and linking it to other struggles that are, yes, union related, but even non-union related. The labor movement should have a big, should be backing Black Lives Matter hugely, should be backing the DACA protests. In some cases, they are, some union locals. And some union locals fight racism, of course, too. But I mean, in a national, very visible way. And also, you know, getting into the $15 minimum wage struggle, Medicare for all, free public education, jobs programs, etc., on a mass scale, a big campaign, putting a lot of money into it. There still is some money in the labor movement from all the union dues and so on, although obviously see here, the big business knows that and wants to cut across that, starting with the public sector. By the way, the public sector unions at 35%, 33% of the workforce, public sector workforce, are much stronger than the 6-7% of the private sector workforce. So if they go after the strongest part of the labor movement, they'll come after the weaker private sector part at this point in time. So that's worth reading as well. Not many people talking about Janus yet. And finally, that, as I mentioned, we'll go out with this. There's a 4-page supplement in the current issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper on the Russian Revolution, the legacy of October. And one little known fact, by the way, which should resonate, given the organizing that's been done for LGBTQ rights and so on, that did you know, for example, that after the Russian Revolution, homosexuality, quote unquote, that's the obviously term from the time, was decriminalized, and that the USSR in its initial years was had a whole range of policies and so on for sexual liberation, including decriminalizing, as I said, homosexuality. It was the first time that, first in the world, to decriminalize homosexuality in the West. They took the lead, many activists in Russia, in the incipient forms of LGBTQ organizing in the world of the 20th century. This is from a thing called Left Voice, an article on gender and sexuality in the Russian Revolution, the decriminalization of homosexuality in the USSR, a milestone in the history of sexual liberation. And that's from November 30th by Rodrigo Lopez, but also it's mentioned in this 4-page supplement in Socialist Alternative. So anyways, it's some quick history about the Russian Revolution, mentioning of John Reed's book, 10 Days That Shook the World, really worth reading, by the way, and a long article going into things that a lot of people don't know about the Russian Revolution and the impact of Russian Revolution in the USA, another article, which is really... amazing when you get into it. The affected area, for example, there was a general strike in Seattle in 1919, led by people that supported the Russian Revolution. And finally, Building an International Then and Now, an article about what's happening now to build socialism on an international scale based on some of the organizing methods and democratic principles of the Russian Revolution, believe it or not. So we're out of time. Thanks for listening to Socialist Alternative. Again, every other week, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective here on WMFO Medford. And we'll go out with, get in touch, socialistalternative.org. And to the extent you see any protests coming up against the tax attack on us by Trump, please get involved and we'll see you out there. Thanks.
London town, where there's voices raised and barricades. Believe me, man, I'm down. Tyrants, bloodsuckers, and bagmen got us picking through the crumbs. Raise your voices all together, motherfucker, here we come.
Worldwide rebel songs, sing out loud all night long. Hang on, man, it won't be long.
Worldwide rebel songs,
sing out loud all night long. Hang on, man, it won't be long. Worldwide.
guitar, bass and drums. Down in Gaza, down in Fresno, out your door and down your street. Are you gonna stand around, or are you gonna be free?